All right.
Okay.
So I am so pleased to introduce to you Mary Louise Chown. And Mary Louise is talking to us today all the way from Manitoba. So we are spread all the way across the country and north and south as well. And Mary Louise and I first met, we were trying to remember, years ago, I think at the UConn Storytelling Festival. And since then, I have learned so many wonderful things about her. She has gotten multiple grants on an individual basis as well as a group basis. And I think it's interesting that on her website she says recent grants as opposed to the previous ones. Mary Louise is a storyteller. She's a writer. A wonderful performer, and she's also a shamanic counselor, which I think really helps her in some of the work that we're going to talk about today. Mary Louise, wouldn't you say so?
Yes.
Yeah, I think that it has a lot about how you carry yourself through the process and listening to people. You're a very good listener. And so I'd like to spend the rest of the time just listening to her and what the rest of us have to say in reaction. So I'm going to turn it over to Mary Louise, and I'm going to say one more time for the people that have just got on, please hit star 6. Is it star 6?
My intention is to not to talk maybe for half an hour, but maybe go halfway through my material that I wanted to share with you, and give an opportunity for people maybe to ask some questions, because they may go, well, tell me about that again, or what did you just say? And then I can go on through more material and then leave some more time. So it'll end up being about half an hour of discussion or questions, but perhaps broken up. We'll try that out. I'm going to start by reading you this quote from Margaret Lawrence from her book, The Heart of a Stranger. Some of you might know Margaret Lawrence, so she's a Canadian writer, but here it is. A strange place it was, that place where the world began, a place of incredible happenings, splendors and revelations, despairs like multitudinous pits of isolated hells, a place of shadow, spookiness, inhabited by the unknowable dead, a place of jubilation, and of mourning, horrible and beautiful. It was, in fact, a small prairie town. Now, she starts The Heart of a Stranger with those words, but I thought afterwards, you know, that also could be a hospital ward. It could be anywhere where there's just human beings gathered together for some purpose. It is the most melodramatic and the most wonderful, and sometimes the most awful of places. So that's how I'm going to introduce you into that whole world of storytelling and hospice and palliative care. And I guess I will start off by giving you a little bit of background. For some reason, which I really don't know, I would say now we're looking at about 14 years ago, I don't know, I got really curious and interested and drawn towards people at the last stages of their life. And I can't really explain even now why that is. I just felt drawn that I wanted to know more and I wanted to be with people. And so I started off by taking an 8-week training course with a Hospice and Palliative Care Manitoba to be one of those people that goes into people's homes and does respite so that a caregiver can leave, you know, for the afternoon. But before I had a chance to work with anybody, I ran into an old friend of mine from Fine Arts, and she was selling a quilt in a local mall, and it turned out she had started something called Manitoba Artists in Healthcare. And I said, oh, I'll help. And so the next thing I knew, I was working at St. Boniface Hospital, being paid as an artist, a visiting artist in hospitals, through the money that my friend Sherry Johnson had raised through her quilt raffle. And so we were really, three of us, the first people to do that in Manitoba. We were paid hourly, and we went on to all sorts of different wards in the hospital. But because I had taken this hospice and palliative care 8-week training course, they said I could go on to the palliative care ward. And so for 6 years, I worked as a visiting artist, telling stories and playing music at various hospice and palliative care facilities in Winnipeg. And then I went on to write a book about that. And I also, about halfway through my work with Manitoba Artists in Healthcare, I got a chance to study for a week at the Creative Center of New York. Some of you might know of that. It's a whole week's intensive training course on working in hospital settings. It was a wonderful opportunity. And my latest thing that I'm doing now, I'm no longer working in a hospice and palliative care as a paid artist. The grant money kind of has run out for now. I hope that happens again in the future. But I'm involved with presenting a three-part series of teaching weekend workshops on in the Buddhist tradition on meditation on death and dying. And I'm part of a three-person team that we take people through the various aspects of being with people who are dying. So back to my book, and I'll get into that a little bit. I would say that I kept a log while I was a visiting artist in healthcare. We were required to do that because we were paid. And being a teacher, it was easy for me to keep a running record because I'd done that most of my life. Then people started asking me to come and talk to them. Oh, Edmonton, I talked there, and in Ottawa, and Brighton, England, and in Australia when I was there. They wanted to know, well, what did you do in the hospital? They were interested because I was a non-medical hospital visitor, and my emphasis was on bringing the art of storytelling into healthcare. And there was so much interest in that that... And some of the patients that I did visit as well, that I got to know fairly well, also said, oh, you should write a book. Well, as some of you who are writers know, that's easier said than done. And so my reason, I decided to write a book to reflect on my experiences and what I had gained and learned, and also to celebrate the patients and the staff and the families that I'd met, and also to illustrate for others, well, how do I go about working as an artist in healthcare? And I also wanted to encourage others to bring practices that they know and love into hospital settings in order to engage patients in the gift of life. And also, I wanted to give explicit examples of interactions with patients. Now, this works best when people are in long-term care, of course, hospice, palliative care, or elderly patients, you know, as they say in Manitoba, being paneled or waiting to go to some assisted living. And a person coming in strictly for surgery, you know, the turnaround time is quite quick. And so it wasn't as optimum a ward to work on as far as storytelling went in order to get to know the patients. Now, my book is in the form of a narrative rather than a theoretical work because I wanted it to be interesting to read on many levels. It's really a book by a working artist. And my other reason for writing it in that sense was I really couldn't find very many books on how to be a storyteller in healthcare. So I would say that the work I did in hospice and palliative care, I would call it transitional storytelling and transitional story listening. I would like to have a little snappier word for that, but that's what I've come up with. Because I was telling stories of my own, folk tales, personal stories, that I thought would be appropriate for the transition between health and illness and the transition between life and death. And then I was also listening to the stories that my patients told me and their families. Because I believe the stories we carry within ourselves and we tell ourselves affects our relationship with not only us, but the world and others. And when we can tell our stories, it helps us remember who we were, and it discovers and shapes who we are. And I feel that I was really helping patients, I guess, for want of a better word, metabolize their experiences. And I found that when patients told me stories, they really did not see it as storytelling. Because often what they said came out in, well, short anecdotes or comments, and my role would be helping them to understand that that was a story, and it was an important story. Now, there's a lot of research on story listening and storytelling that does show that it can give form and voice to experience, and that telling and listening to life stories can give meaning to people or restore meaning. And I think in my case it was the restoring meaning, because many of the people that I would tell stories to or listen to their stories were dealing with life-threatening illnesses, with pain management, with adjusting to, well, I can't do this anymore, maybe I can't go home anymore. Everything's changed for me. What is still there about me? So I think that I've helped them perhaps uncover or remember their own wisdom. So I'm just looking at the time here. 8:19. Okay, I'm going to break for a minute, and I will tell you a few things about some of the patients that I met, but I wanted to know whether anybody had any questions for clarification before I moved on.
Well, I wanted to add the title of your book, which I forgot to say in your introduction. This is Allison. And that Mary Louise's book is Now I Know the World is Round, Stories at the End of Life.
Yes. Okay. All right, well, I'll just keep going then. How does that sound?
I think it sounds fine.
Okay. Well, I believe that any time there are multiple stories and subplots unfolding within me telling a story to a patient listening, telling me a story back. And I felt for me the most important thing for me was to be connected with the stories that I told and to be feel confident that when I chose to tell a particular story to a patient, that I had chosen with the patient in mind, not, you know, oh, I'm such a great storyteller, they're going to love this story. But what is it that I think they might want to hear based on my conversation with them? I think it's important that when we tell stories that it comes from somewhere deep inside us, and even the patients who told me stories, it was about what they loved and what they felt deeply about. Another Canadian poet, Robert Croach, has said this: there is no real world, my friends. Why not, then, let the stars shine in our bones? And I love that quote. Okay, well, I'm going to tell you about, what stories did I tell? Quite a few. I didn't learn any stories in particular because I knew I was working in hospice and palliative care. I drew from my own repertoire of stories because, as most of you who are storytellers know, folktales are so multi-layered that there might be one part of a folktale that connects you with your listener. But your listener, of course, sees or connects with possibly many of the other levels. So I had to just trust that the choice that I was making each time, there was one connecting point. And I'll give you an example. The book is named after a wonderful lady, Dorothy Atwell, and she was the patient that gave me permission to use the title The World is Round, because she gave me that title. One day I walked into her hospital room and she said, ah, here's my storyteller. Now I know the world is round, because When I was a child, I loved listening to stories, and now here I am listening to stories again. And I thought, what a perfect title for the book. So, when I first met Dorothy, the staff at the hospice had said, "Won't see Dorothy." Now, she had given me permission to use her name. Some of the other names I've used, I have changed them, but in Dorothy's case, she's given me permission to do that. So I went in and I said, would you like to hear a story? She said, well, how long is your story? Rather dubiously. And I said, 5 minutes. Well, okay, she said. So I told her the story, Gail Rosen's version of the story, The Woman Who Cheated Death. It's in one of Allison Cox's storytelling communities, I believe that's the one. Well, she laughed about that. Some of you probably know that story. In the end, she doesn't die because the angel of death is so afraid of her. She's all covered in honey and feathers, and she scares the angel of death away. So then I said, "Do you want to hear another story?" "Yes," she said. And I said, "Well, this one's about the prophet Elijah." And a lot of you probably know this story where there's a version in, I believe, Jane Yolen's book, Grey Heroes, about the old man who meets the prophet Elijah on the riverbank and he's given a wish. So after the story was finished, I said to Dorothy, "Well, what would you wish for?" Thinking, I don't know, I thought she'd wish to be home. And she said she wanted to have a long life. No hesitation there. She said to me that she thought people lived a long life if they ate lots of yogurt and maybe had a drop of sherry every day. So she was ready to laugh. And it seemed like from then on, she would say to me, "Do not pass by my room without coming in and telling me a story." So she kind of brackets my book because she was one of the last patients that I met. And she was in hospice and palliative care for several months. And so I got to know her really well. And now this might be strange, but her favorite story was The Magic Fish, which many of you probably know a version of, where the husband catches the fish, but he lets it go, and the fish grants him a wish, and he can't think of what to wish for, and his wife gives him action because he should have wished for any number of things, and he didn't. He figured he had everything. And in many of the versions of that fish story, the wife keeps asking for things and asking and asking. And when I would tell this to Dorothy, she'd say to me, "My God, what does that woman want next?" So she was just a wonderful person to tell the story to, because I'd say to her, "Yes, that's what the fish was thinking too." And in the end, in the many of the traditional versions of that story, the fish takes everything away, and the husband and wife are back to being dirt poor. But there was one version I heard at a festival in Edmonton. I believe it was written by a Newfoundland author, and I don't know the name because I've never found it again. At any rate, the end of the story, the fish does take everything away. It says, "You want too much. I'm going to leave you with one gift because you didn't kill me. I'm leaving you with the gift of contentment." And Dorothy, I don't know, I think that's why she must have liked that story, is the idea of contentment. Because even though she wanted to live a long life, and of course that wasn't going to happen, I think she was content with her life. Okay, so that was Dorothy. I want to tell you about someone else who's completely different. Sometimes, well, lots of times, people would say, "I don't have anything to tell you. My life's not interesting at all." And so I would have to encourage them. And one time around Christmas at one of the hospices that I worked at, the staff said, "Oh, go and see." Again, I can tell you his name. It's J and D, like the letters J-D. And they said, "He's really grumpy." I have permission from his wife to tell this story, so it's okay for me to do this. So I went in, and I had my hammer dulcimer with me, and I played it, and he was really grumpy. He was walking around, sitting down, lying down, standing up. He was obviously in pain. And after playing my dulcimer, he picked up the phone and started phoning somebody. So I stopped playing, but he waved me on like, don't stop playing, don't stop playing. And so I didn't. I started again. Turned out he was calling his wife, and he was saying, there's this really short woman in the, because I'm very short, I'm under 5 feet, and she's playing this instrument right now in my room. And he held the phone up so that his wife could hear. So, turned out I went and visited him up until the day before he died. And he said he had nothing interesting to tell me. Would I just please play the dulcimer? But in between my visits, I would say, well, so where were you born? Or, you know, did you and your wife have any children? Or, oh, where did you work? And I had a lot of information that he gave me in short sentences. And so one day, I wrote them all out, and I put them in the form of a story. And I knew that his name was Sicilian, and we have a local Italian grocery store. I phoned them up, and I asked them about the word JD. Hello? Somebody coming on there? Okay. I asked them about the word JD. They told me, actually, JD meant little bird in Sicilian. So I went in to see JD, and I read him the story of his life as much as he told me. And I started off by saying, little bird, once long ago a baby boy was born, and his parents gave him a name when he was baptized, but he was never called by that name, for he was known to this day as JD, short for Jadutsa, which means little bird. And I went on to tell him everything he had told me, where he worked and what his wife's name was, and he just started to cry. He put his hands over his face, and I thought, oh, what have I done? I've upset him. So I stopped reading. Well, he took one hand away from his face, and he commanded me to keep on reading, keep on reading. So I read a bit more, and then he started crying again. And I stopped, and he goes, don't stop, don't stop, keep reading. It was a really simple story, just, you know, four paragraphs. And at one point I said that he met his wife at Christie's Biscuits, and I don't know if it was love at first sight. And he blurted out, well, you never asked me if it was love at first sight. And then he started crying again. So I thought to myself, well, next time I see him, I'm going to ask him about meeting his wife. Well, I never saw him again, because when I came into about 2 days later for my shift at the hospice, he had passed away. And when I spoke to the staff at the hospice, I was kind of concerned, but they said, you know, it was probably really good that somebody told him back his story, because so many of their patients think they have nothing important to say. They're just ordinary people, and who would be interested anyways? And so the staff actually really helped me realize that I had probably done what my intuition told me was the right thing by telling him back his own story. And the chapter that story's in, I call These Brilliant Threads. And the quote comes from a really great book, if any of you are interested. It's called The Wisdom of Dying, Practices for Living by Dr. Michael Murphy. And the quote, I'll read it to you. This is what this man needed to die in peace, witnesses to the brilliant threads of his life. Now, he was talking about another man in the book, but when I thought of J.D., I thought, well, I think that's what's happened. I've just been a witness. All right, enough about that. Let me just check the time here. Oh, I think I have a few more things to say. I'm going to wait and see if anybody has any questions. So anybody want to comment or ask anything right now?
I Could you repeat the name of the book by Dr. Michael Murphy?
Yes, The Wisdom of Dying, Practices for Living.
Okay, thank you.
I also have a simple question as well. You were breaking up a little bit when you were talking about the fisherman's wife story, and you said that at the end, that version said that the fish allowed them to keep one thing, and what was it?
Contentment.
Contentment. Okay,
yes.
Thank you.
And I never liked that story until I heard that version.
Yeah, that is different.
It was so different.
Yeah, very.
I wish I could comment on exactly. It was probably a retold story published, and this particular teller at the Edmonton Festival told it. And it wasn't until I got back to Winnipeg and I realized I liked that, and I couldn't remember the teller's name, and I couldn't remember who she said the author of the story was who had put that different ending on. So it's not my brilliant thought. It's somebody else decided to end it that way. Okay, so shall I keep going then? Oh, for a bit. Oh, somebody's coming in?
Yes.
Yes? Did you have a question or comment?
Hi.
Laura, hi.
Hi.
Oh, you've just joined us.
Yeah, a little bit ago. I just got
home. Okay, so shall I just keep going then? I was just stopping to see if anybody had any questions or anything they wanted to ask.
I think we're waiting with bated breath.
Oh, wow. Okay. Well, you know, I thought about what I've learned. And, you know, it's really not that difficult to go and be with people who are ill. So I put down a few things here that I wanted to tell you that of things I had learned, and some of this will resonate with many of you, I know. One thing I've learned is it takes longer to process anything when you're ill. And in my case, when you're older as well, I just turned 70 in March. Or if you're in a new situation, if you think back to a situation you've been in and where you're thinking, oh, why was I like that? It's because if it's a new situation, sometimes it takes longer to process. And so with people who are ill or their families and even staff who work with them, everything needs to not be rushed, except, of course, emergency medication or something like that. So what is in my mind and how I think when I go into a patient's bedroom, it's really critical. And that's really the only thing any of us have any control over. But it's your strength as well. So another word I would have for this would be mindfulness. And, of course, Laura's probably written a lot about that as well. Being aware of how you are feeling and about how you are thinking about things at any given time is crucial. And it's really crucial when you're working with people who are ill because they are so vulnerable. And if you are a non-medical person visiting, you are so welcome for the most part because you're not there to give medication. You're not there for meals. You're not there to give them the news that, you know, I've got to have another surgery or, well, things aren't looking so good. And you're not a family member who's going, oh, I hope you get better or, you know, I'm resenting the fact that you're there. You have none of that baggage. So how you think is crucial. And it reminded me of a story that I told when I was talking to some volunteers at one of the hospices. And some of you maybe know that story of the Chinese story of the farmer who one day went to do some cutting and couldn't find his axe. And he noticed the neighbor's son using an axe, and he thought, he's stolen my axe. I always thought that kid was a thief. I mean, he's got shifty eyes. Well, of course. And he just made up this whole picture of that neighbor's son. And then he was out in one of his outlying fields later that day, and he found his axe, and he realized he had misplaced it. And when he came back to his house and he looked at the neighbor's son didn't look shifty anymore. He just looked like an ordinary son of a neighbor. And so it's all about how we think of things. One time when I was going with a friend of mine on a bike trip, we were in grade 8, and I always used to make my lunch ahead of time, and I made my lunch the day before. And my friend Joanna came, and we got on our bikes, and I couldn't find my lunch in the fridge. And my brother, who was 18 months older than me, was always playing jokes and tricks. So I said, "Well, my brother's stolen my lunch. He's always doing stuff like that. He's a terrible brother." And I made a second lunch. And we went off on our bike trip. We were gone all day. I came back home, and when I went to bed that night, my lunch was up in my bedroom. But I'd spent the whole day thinking how awful my brother was. So, yeah. And so that got me to be thinking of what's the most important thing if you are a visitor, a storyteller, working with people who are very ill. And I could sum it up in no agenda. Don't go with any agenda whatsoever. That sounds simple, but it can be quite difficult. It takes practice. If I have no agenda when I go and visit a patient or I'm sitting with that family member or even a staff person, then I'm free to just observe, to be comfortable with silence, to be curious. To be thinking, what is the thing that this person needs that I could perhaps give? What can I do? And it meant for me that crucial memories or insights would often come up for patients. And they would often say, "Why did I think of that? Oh, that just came into my mind." And I think it was because I wasn't imposing any of my, "Well, I think you should say this," or "I think you should be doing this," on them. I was almost like a tabula rasa, just sitting there. They weren't uncomfortable with me there or anything like that. I remember this one, I went into an elderly nun's room once, and I had a little lap, what was it called? An altered auto harp. In my book, I explain how I altered it, but I was playing it, and she was commenting on it. And how when she was growing up, there was music in her home. And I said, "Oh, you know, where did you grow up?" All of a sudden, she said, "I can remember I was a child. I was two or three, and it was snowing. And my dad said to me, 'Come, we're going to go and get Leontina of the swamp. Come.' And he took my hand, and we walked across the farm field, and the snowflakes fell in my eyes. And my father said, 'Close your eyes.' And we got Leontina, and she came back to the house. And then a little while later, I heard the sound of a new baby." It was a tiny little story. And then when I asked her a bit more about it afterwards, it was this sharp, sharp memory of walking across a snowy field with snow in your eyes to get Leontina, who lived on their farm but in a little hut by herself, who was a midwife. So, I mean, she didn't wake up that morning thinking she was going to tell this woman that came into her room about Leontina of the swamp. But it was a wonderful time we had together. It was such a sharp memory for her, and I think it gave her a great deal of pleasure because she was ready to die. She was very devout, and she had put her life in order, and she was just waiting, really. And another one was, I was in this other lady's room, and she had this wonderful image. Again, we were just sitting, and I told her a story that another patient had told me about a white stone. If there's time, I might tell you that. And I had a stone myself, a real smooth stone I'd found at the beach, and I put it in her hand. And she said to me, "I have to give up my place on the water. and her sister was there at her side, and her sister immediately seemed to know what she was meaning. This, she needed to die, and she knew it, and she was holding this stone in her hand, and it was just such a wonderful moment, that image of I have to give up my place on the water. And she did die the next day, but for her to be able to articulate that in that such a beautiful poetic way, I think was a real gift for her and for her sister. It was very calming. So the no agenda, let's go further into that. I'll go further to even say non-prescriptive listening. And how hard is that to do? Can we listen to others without offering our opinions? I'm making that mistake right now with some of my grown children. I think I'm listening, but really I'm going, but why don't you do this? Or, well, if I were you, I would do that. And I'm thinking, I'm not even following my own advice here. This is very difficult. But the other way to look at it would be, if you were putting air in a balloon, you are forcing air into the balloon, and it's the pressure of the air is opening the balloon and making it bigger and bigger and bigger till it's full of air. But when we breathe, we are not doing that. When we breathe in, our lungs are expanding and allowing the air to come in. And then we are allowing the air to leave on the out-breath. And if we could think of listening as allowing, expanding that inner part of ourselves to allow either the silence of the patient or they're not their silence, their words, just to come in and then to leave again. To me, that's what listening, it's the gift of being fully present to this person that's near you. Now, I call that accompanying. I want to read you something from my book. I was giving a workshop, well, it was a house concert in Ottawa, and one of the storytellers that came said, well, do you tell stories in the hospital to make them feel better, to make them laugh or forget about their illness? And I said to her, well, partly, but mostly I tell stories I think they will want to hear based on the conversations that we've had. It's like the story I offer comes to me from my experience with the patient. Well, then later in the evening, we had a break, and she came over again, and she said, so you don't tell stories to make people feel better? Well, I said, not exactly. It was a really good question she asked me because she really got me thinking. I said, although they may feel better as they listen to the story. So then she persisted. Then why do you tell stories? And I said, well, to accompany them, to be with them where they are. And for the longest time, I liked that term, accompanying. And then, about 6 months ago, I don't know if any of you have heard of Roshi Joan Halifax, who's a Zen Buddhist nun. She's at the Upaya Institute in, New Mexico or Arizona. Anyway, she came to Winnipeg and was talking at a cancer care conference. And she had this beautiful image. You're in a canoe, and you're going downstream, and there's another canoe. And, you know, if any of you have ever been in a canoe, or maybe even a kayak, and you come alongside, and you talk for a while, and maybe you put your hand to the gunwale, and you hold each other's gunwales, and you talk a little bit, and the water's still moving you downstream. And she calls it coming alongside. And what I would call accompanying, she calls coming alongside. And I think I like that even better because you're kind of with them for a while and then maybe you go ahead or maybe they go ahead. Maybe you catch up with them or maybe you don't. But it's a wonderful image if you're ever trying to figure out how to be with people who are ill. Think about coming alongside in a canoe. And that will guide you. So, my intention, of course, when I visit, is to just be curious, just you know, about them. And so here's another way to look at that. I gave a talk once to some student nurses because their instructor had noticed that when they were doing their rotations at the hospice, they were becoming like she was as a nurse, like in with the medication and out, and, oh, I got to get to this patient. But she said to me, you know, you just go in and you sit. And I did tell her, well, I'm not a nurse, so I have that luxury, let's say, of having more time. But she said, yes, but could you talk to the students and tell them that they actually have more time than they think? Is there some way I've been telling them, can you tell them differently? So there was about six of them, and we were together for a couple of hours. And this is straight from, you know, fine arts school of how do you develop your ideas kind of thing. And I asked them to do two things, and I could maybe ask you to do the same, or if you are working with people, maybe you have done this. Think about a chair. That's the first thing. If you are sitting in the seat of judgment, what kind of seat is it? What does it look like? How are you sitting? You know, are you up straight and your arms are on the arms, and you're maybe dressed very formally and you're looking out at this person you're judging? And if you were sitting in the seat of curiosity, it might be a less formal chair. You might be sitting at the edge of the chair. You might be leaning forward. So the students and I talked about that. And then I said, well, think about it another way. Think about putting a hat on. And the hat is a judgment hat. I am going to judge what you ought to be able to be doing right now. Here's the hat I'm wearing. And then take that hat off and put on the hat of curiosity. And I was trying to find ways to help the students, and I think it worked because somewhat later on their rotation, a couple of the students came over to me and said, you know, I remembered about that hat. And when I went in to see the patients, I put the hat of curiosity on and sat down for a few minutes while I was giving them their pills. And it only took a few seconds longer, but I didn't feel rushed, and I didn't feel like I had to solve any problems. So I'm just throwing that out. I'm sure that some of you that are online now that have done a lot of teaching maybe have done something like that anyways. But when I gave a talk to some hospital volunteers on another time, and I talked about that idea of non-prescriptive listening and non-judgmental. And the volunteer coordinator came over to me afterwards and specifically thanked me for going to that subject matter, because she said they'd recently had a couple of instances of people having inappropriate responses to patients based on a judgment call. And it's really difficult, you know, people like us that, well, I'm a teacher, former teacher, you know, it's a helping profession. We're often like, you know, if I know what I can do to help you if you'd only just listen to me. And I want to help you. I want to make life better for you. So it's really an easy trap to fall into to say, I know what you should do, or I know what you should be thinking right now. So if you kind of let your curiosity guide you and your thought of, how could I be the most helpful right now for that person? It may be less easy for you to fall into that judgment trap. We often know the right thing to do in a situation if we're guided by our intuition and by our non-judgment and by our caring. Now, Michael Murphy kind of sums that up as well in his book. He says, caregivers, and that means all of us, need preparation to attend to the dying, and that preparation must be experiential and not theoretical. Just get in there and do it. And so we're getting to the point of a safe place. There's a storytelling exercise that I learned from Marilyn Perringer and Linda Howes in Storytelling School of Toronto, and I've used it for years with storytelling classes. I call it the heart of the matter. And I drum and I ask people to go in their imagination to a place they feel safe. I'm sure a lot of you have done a similar exercise. But I realized that by being the way I've just described, no agenda, going in and visiting a patient, that I've actually allowed them in their hospital bed to be in a safe place, in their mind. They can be. They don't have to be in the hospital bed. And so it just emerges on its own. You don't even have to try very hard. You just have to be there. And they might hear a story, or they might listen to some music, or I might notice a photograph and ask them about it. And right away, they're in this other wonderful place, and they tell me something. So I call that the heart of the matter. And I guess it's they're just both of the most important things I would say that I have learned from working with patients. I'm just going to check the time. Ooh, 8:54. All right, I'm going to stop, see if anybody wants to say anything. Dead silence.
I'm curious to know, this is Rona, I'm curious to know how, what your advice would be, how you would approach this if you are a relative of the dying person.
Yeah, it's a difficult situation sometimes to be in. I've had that happen with family members of my own who have died.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in my case, the practicing of being, having no agenda, when I first started doing that, I made a practice of it, almost like a meditation where I would, if I had to go into the washroom nearby, I'd do that. Or I would sometimes, it would take me 15 minutes, and then it got to the point where I could do it like in about 15 seconds. I would sort of ground myself. I would say, okay, everything's fine. I'm going to see this person now. What I'm making for supper doesn't matter anymore. I'm connected with the earth. I'm connected with the sky. I want to do anything that's helpful. And as I say, sometimes at first it took me quite a while to get to that state. But with practice, it can come in a few seconds, just a few breaths in and out. And so in the case of my mother or my brother, when they were dying, or my grandfather, I was able to just be there. Now, in my case, we didn't have a lot of issues, though. You know, if you have a lot of issues with the person that you're with, it can be very difficult, but it's really worth it, because imagine this person is going on a around-the-world cruise. Now, this is not my image. It's somebody else's, but I love it. And you're standing at the dock, and they're hanging over the rail waving goodbye, and you're at the dock, and you're saying, oh, don't go. And the boat's going away, and the last thing they hear from you is, don't go, don't go, as opposed to, they're going to run around the world cruise. They've never done that before. And you're standing at the dock and you're going, have a great trip. Well, that was Sogyal Rinpoche that talked about that in his book, The Tibetan Book of Living and Dying. If you can have that frame of mind before you go in, say, okay, ever helps. And sometimes silence. If something comes to the top of your tip of your tongue that you want to say because that habit's there, don't say it. I don't know if that helps. Does it?
Yeah, I love that image. I love that image of the cruise. Yeah.
Yeah. It's really hard to say to somebody, have a great trip.
Mm-hmm.
But I like that image too. And as I say, it's not mine. It's Sogyal Rinpoche's.
This is Elisa.
I just want to say there's so many just lovely little gems that you've given us. I feel very rich right now. I love the story about the grumpy guy and how it was just you're making a list and then reading them back that was enough to, you know, just make him, help him feel affirmed that mm-hmm. so often we feel like we have to have some gem, but that was the gem.
Yeah, so just a simple life.
Yeah, really
but a marvelous life.
Yeah. Everyone, what do they say? Everyone's life could be made into a full-length feature motion picture or something like that. It's true.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah.
True.
So I just wanted to say thank you for
work,
and
nice
I love the
mindful
approach. Mm. Others, care to unmute?
Thank
anybody
you. This
else?
Has been very interesting.
Okay, good.
Hi,
who's
this
back?
Is Jane Krause. I just want to say thank you so much, Mary Louise. This has been such a rich gift and such a blessing tonight. Thank you so much.
Oh, thanks for saying that.
My pleasure.
This is Karen, unmuted. I just want to thank you for your wonderful words of wisdom. I really appreciate everything you had to say.
Good.
My mother was a doctor, and she was the medical director of a hospice for the last 25 years of her life.
Ooh.
And I think she would have really appreciated everything you had to say.
Hmm.
She worked with a lot of patients, and she would always say when you see somebody at the final stages of life to honor where they are by being a listener and not just
mm-hmm.
a talker.
Well, they're fortunate to have her then.
I especially appreciated your image of the boat. There's a beautiful poem that I frequently send to people when they've lost a loved one about the ship going out to sea and how there's the perspective of seeing the ship sailing away, but then there's
uh-huh.
the perspective of the one who receives the ship and sees the broadness of the sails and the beautiful boat coming in.
Oh.
Do you know that poem?
No. I'll send it to you, Mary Louise. I have a copy.
Oh.
If anybody else...
Do you know the poem I'm speaking of?
Yeah, it's my favorite. This is Allison. And
well,
I
if not,
it
I must go down
to
the sea again.
It's one of my very favorite poems. So when you mentioned the idea of
uh-huh.
saying, you know,
I'd love to.
Wishing someone
I'd
a
love
good
to.
Trip, I thought of that beautiful poem image.
Uh-huh. Oh, please send it to me. That would be lovely.
Yeah, I would love a copy of it, too. How can we get a hold of it?
Tell you what, I can post it on the Healing Story Alliance. I was just dashing over here to my computer to see if I could actually pull it out and read it to you all before we say
that would be great.
Sign off.
Do you remember what it's called? What's the title?
Yeah, I'll look for it. Let's see. I just found it last week. I will find it. I will find it because I just sent it to my sister last week.
There you go.
Let me
just
find it.
It's not Tennyson, Monet, Sunset, and Evening Star?
No.
Okay.
It's very specific.
Then I don't know it. Okay.
I'm going to find
it
right now.
I look forward to getting it.
I'm going to find it right now. Let's see.
And while we're looking, was there
yeah,
anybody
keep talking.
Else
I'll find it.
That had some comments or thoughts or questions?
Yeah, this is...
Hello?
Hello. Hello.
Got very quiet. I don't know if we lost Mary Louise.
No, I'm still here. I'm just... wanting to not talk in case somebody wants to ask or say
yeah,
a comment.
Yeah, yeah.
Allison, I wanted to let Mary, this is Gert Johnson.
Hi, Gert.
I wanted to thank Mary Louise for sharing in a way that really enriched each one of us personally, I think, as well as professionally.
Yeah, what a gift.
Yeah, the little tidbits that she told are little pieces of wisdom for each of us as we travel through life with those that we love who are dying or as we approach death ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's definitely
thank
what
you.
They have taught me.
Yeah, thank you, Mary Louise.
Well, thanks.
I'm so struck by this is Laura, the kind of odd silence that we have on the telephone that feels very different from the richness and connection of the silence because you're there, so present, that you
right.
talked about.
Mm-hmm.
I found the poem.
Good, because I was just going to say the same thing.
I just found it, yeah. Huh. Shall I read it?
What's it called?
Yes, please. It's
okay.
Lovely.
It's called The Ship. It's by Bishop Brent. I am standing on the seashore. The ship sails in the morning breeze and starts for the ocean. She's an object of beauty, and I stand watching her till at last she fades on the horizon, and someone at my side says, she is gone. Gone. Where? Gone from my sight, that is all. She is just as large in the mast, hull, and spars as she was when I saw her, and just as able to bear her load of living freight to its destination. The diminished size and total loss of sight is in me, not in her. And just at the moment when someone at my side says, she is gone, there are others who are watching her coming, and other voices take up a glad shout. There she comes.
Oh, I love that.
Isn't
that's
it lovely?
Wonderful.
And
oh,
actually,
it's a lovely poem.
I think Bishop Brent added a couple lines on the end, but there's a previous author that originally wrote it, so I'll look for that. And
oh, really?
And I'll post it on Healing Story Alliance.
Oh, there's another author. Okay.
Yeah. And,
that would
and
be great.
Before we hang up, I just wanted to tell everybody also that next month we're going to have Abigail Fisher-Lang, who's from Vancouver, British Columbia, talking about using storytelling and her work is Celebrancy, which is a nice follow-up to this because
mm-hmm.
she's talking about passages of life. It's not just weddings. It's also births and deaths and all those transitions that we travel through. So I hope that you can join us. And again, Mary Louise, what a gift. Storyteller, author, musician, counselor, and a lovely book. So I hope that people can get that. And the title of it is, again,
Now
I Know
the World Is
Round, Stories at the End of Life. And who's the publisher, Mary Louise?
Art Bookbindery.
And that's out of?
A Lady Slipper, what is it? Hang on a minute. Yeah.
Is that out of Toronto?
Yeah. No, Winnipeg.
Winnipeg, okay.
Yeah.
So thanks, everybody, for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And hopefully you'll
thank
join
you.
Us again in a month. And then Mary Louise and I are the editors of the Healing Story Alliance Journal, so we're still looking for people to make submissions
yeah.
about their storytelling and healing work. We'd love to hear from you.
Yeah.
Have a good evening.
Yeah, please.
Great. Thank you.
Hey, thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks. Bye-bye.